Welcome to The Goodnight Show. I'm Shay Morrison, sleep expert and co-founder of The Goodnight Co. Join me each week for hints and tips on all things sleep. Welcome back to The Goodnight Show. It's a term everyone has heard of, but few people really know a lot about. Insomnia. In today's episode, I'm speaking to Professor Drew Dawson and unpacking how insomnia differs from everyday sleep deprivation, sleep apnea, or just poor sleep quality. Professor Drew Dawson is nationally and internationally recognised for his contributions to scientific community and to industry in the areas of sleep fatigue research, organisational psychology and human behaviour, industrial relations, and the human implications of hours of work and sleep. As director of the internationally recognised Appleton Institute, he oversees basic and applied research into the effects of shift work and sleep loss on the health and well-being of employees. Basic research programs are focused on the interactions of sleep and circadian rhythms, the effects of sleep loss, and the ways people protect themselves against fatigue-related errors. Drew is a wealth of knowledge, and I have been lucky enough to catch up with him on multiple occasions to have many discussions about sleep. He certainly comes with a huge background in this area, and as we said, is nationally and internationally recognised. And I just love getting right into the depths of conversations about sleep with him, because he really knows what he's talking about. This is really not an episode to be missed, and we certainly will be catching up with Drew in season 3 to discuss some other areas around sleep. So sit back and have a listen, and I hope you get as much out of it as what I did. So Drew, the first question I love to ask our guests is, how did you sleep last night?
It's a terrible thing to say. Unlike mechanics and their cars, I actually had a fabulous night's sleep last night. Not least of which because I'd spent most of the day in the garden undertaking quite physically hard activity. So that always makes you sleep a lot better than if you're just sitting around watching TV all day, I suspect.
I love that for that to be my night every night. But for people who can't get the physicalness and the outside activity, what are some things that you think that they could be doing in their day-to-day that might help for that nighttime relief?
Well, the first thing to do is to think about people's expectations about sleep. And that can be quite a challenging thing. A lot of people think that they should get 8 hours sleep every night, the same as they did when they were 17 or 18, although they probably didn't then because they're too busy partying. But we often see people who say, oh, I didn't get much sleep last night, or I tossed and turned. And when you actually start to unpack that and say, what do you think is a reasonable amount of sleep? And then most importantly, if you start to say to people, other than being awake in bed at night, and that can be a bit boring, what are the negative side effects in your life of not getting as much sleep? And what you'll find is a very significant number of people have expectations that are unreasonable. And there's a group of people who have perfectly realistic expectations and still don't get a good night's sleep. But in many cases, the norms around 8 hours of sleep have been established from years past when people were much less physically active. They engaged in work that was much, much less demanding from a physical and mental perspective than it is in many cases these days due to automation and machines and those kind of things. So the critical definition is not so much how much sleep you get or whether you're lying awake at night, but are there any negative consequences in your life as a result of not sleeping at night? And what we typically find is about a third to a half of people who report not getting enough sleep don't actually report having problems associated with that. So sometimes you have to say, well, when you were 14, you could probably run 100 metres in 14 seconds. You can't do it at 60. So your sleep changes as you age, for example, or your sleep changes if you have a medical condition where you've got pain or those kind of situations. And getting people to understand what's a reasonable expectation can be a very critical part of that first diagnostic phase in understanding whether you have an actual problem or whether you have a belief problem.
I'd love to know a bit more information about the definition of insomnia. You know, the word gets bandied around a lot, and I'd love to know the actual definition of when somebody can say they have insomnia.
Well, you're not going to like the answer to this, but the difficulty is that insomnia is a word in common parlance, and it's also a word that has a highly technical definition. Most people, when they're usually using the term, aren't using it in the strictly medical or scientific sense of it. So it's important to understand is that particularly when words exist in kind of normal language and medical language, people can use them in very, very different ways. But if we look at the definition technically of insomnia, it's somebody who is having persistent trouble either getting to sleep or staying asleep. And technically, the definition is usually that it lasts for 2 weeks or more. So if you're having trouble getting to sleep for 2 weeks or more, or having trouble waking up in the night and getting back to sleep for 2 weeks or more, then you would meet the technical definition of insomnia. That doesn't mean that there isn't a good explanation for it, and there are many medical and mental health issues that can cause that, and there are lots of common medical surgical reasons. Sometimes you can have a really, you know, difficult time in your life while you're wrestling with stuff, and we've seen that in COVID, for example, where people have had trouble sleeping. But it's a completely rational response. That is, there was a good reason to not be sleeping. That's what was happening.
That's right. What do people do? So when they're diagnosing themselves, or when they're going to see, you know, seek help, what should they be doing?
Well, it's an interesting question. We did some work a couple of years back where we went to general practitioners who were dealing with insomnia, and they universally said it really frustrated them. They found it a very difficult condition to deal with. And we had a couple of anthropologists who came in and worked with people, and we tried to work out why it was that doctors found it really difficult to deal with insomniac patients. And it turns out that when people have insomnia, they break the rules of the medicine man or woman, as the case may be. But traditionally, people come to the doctor, describe symptoms, the doctor then diagnoses it, and then prescribes some sort of treatment or tells you what the likely consequence or prognosis of that disease entity will be. People break the rules when it comes to sleep. Mm. So people come in and they say, "Doctor, I'm having trouble sleeping. I need sleeping tablets." So what the patients have done is to take on the role of the doctor, which is to say, "I've diagnosed the problem and I'm going to tell you what the solution is." That is what the treatment is going to be. And what we found was that doctors found that really frustrating because you were doing their job. Mm. So one of the most important things is to don't diagnose and prescribe for yourself. If you're having trouble sleeping, go to the doctor, describe the symptoms, allow the doctor to do their job, and allow the doctor to work out a treatment that's most appropriate for you. Doctors in particular found when people said, "I've got a sleeping problem and I want sleeping tablets," that put them in a very difficult position. Mm. It's understandable because lots of people say, "I've been coming to you for years and I know what I need," and people understand that. But when you, particularly if you're going to a new doctor or a doctor that you don't see regularly, that sets off a whole set of alarm bells around medication use and those kind of things. So understanding what your role as the patient is and what the doctor's role can be a really good step in improving that relationship around insomnia.
And if there are people that want to take some steps to try and help themselves, so for those people that may not want to go to a doctor and want to try and solve it themselves, what would you recommend that they do?
Well, and again, it's the first question we always ask people is around, why do you have trouble sleeping? And often, you know, people will tell you why. They say, "Oh, because I'm up working nights and the bloke next door has got the lawnmower on when I'm trying to sleep." Or they say, "Oh, I've got terrible pain because of arthritis," or those kind of things. So one of the things that we're often looking for, is there something that is causing the sleep disruption that's completely normal? That is, it's not an atypical or an unexplained insomnia. And in many cases, people will have, you know, they get up every night and they have to go to pee 3 and 4 or 5 times a night. And that may be secondary to bladder problems, or it may be secondary to a prostate problem in older men, et cetera. It may be that they've had an operation and they've got a lot of pain. They may have chronic conditions such as osteoarthritis or those kind of things. They might have sleep apnea. That is, there may be a reason why their sleep is difficult for them. And the first thing is to identify what we call secondary causes. That is where the sleep problem is secondary to some other cause. And again, one of the things to do is when you talk to your doctor about that, that's really important. But if it is the case that you can work out in your mind that it's because I've got arthritis, then you need to say, well, that is probably not surprising, and that might be the consequence of that. And, you know, if I have trouble sleeping, maybe I have to allocate a little bit more time to sleeping. Mm. On the other hand, we have a group of particularly older people who don't have a lot going on in their lives. And while they will report insomnia, we actually refer to them having, and this is somewhat facetious, disorders of excessive wakefulness. That is, there's more day than there's time to do things. So those people will typically be going to bed at 9 o'clock at night and sleeping through till 7 or 8 or 9 o'clock the next morning. They're spending 12 hours in bed. Mm-hmm. They may have allocated 12 hours time in bed because there's not a lot going on and, you know, there's only so much television you can watch. What you'll find in that situation is those people may end up spending 2 or 3 or 4 hours awake at night in bed and then rate their sleep as quality as very poor. When you actually count the amount of sleep they had, they actually didn't do too badly. And, and this is one of those things we're talking around about earlier in terms of expectation. Most people judge the quality of their sleep by how much time they spend awake in bed. Mm. And one of the most interesting treatments we have for insomnia, sometimes referred to as sleep restriction, is where we say you can't go to bed till 12 o'clock at night and you must get up by 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. And then people spend all of their time in bed asleep. Now, in both situations, they're getting, say, 6 or 7 hours of sleep. In one case, they say, I had a terrible sleep. I lay awake all night. And in the other situation, because they weren't laying awake at night, they said, I had a fabulous night's sleep. I slept the whole way through. And again, this goes back to this interesting issue around expectation and people's understanding of, other than being awake at night, do I actually have a problem in my life? That is, am I falling asleep? Am I struggling to work well? So it is complicated. One of the reasons is because you can't remember sleeping, you don't register that 6 or 7 hours. All you remember is the 4 or 5 hours you spent in bed. Mm. So one of the very simple things is spend less time in bed. And if that reduces the amount of time awake in bed, that's a good thing. That being said, it's often difficult for people to do that because they don't have things to do. And particularly at the moment, we see for older people who have, you know, cost problems, going to bed means much less energy use than putting the heater on and those kind of things. So sometimes people are spending more time in bed by necessity rather than by choice.
So how do people work that out? You know, so for example, there is that recommendation that it's good to try and get to bed before midnight, you know, so that we are cycling through the different sleep stages that we need. So are you saying maybe that's not as important as just working out when you're best going to get that 6 or 7 hours sleep and trying to make that happen, well, regardless of time?
Yeah, if you go to bed at 9 o'clock at night and you get 6 or 7 hours sleep, you're going to wake up at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning. There's nobody to play with.
Some people might like that, particularly mothers.
Well, and that's a whole nother story we can talk about. That in many cases, insomnia as personal space, particularly in busy working women with parenting responsibilities, that's their only time to sit and think and reflect about their lives. But for people who go to bed too early, so to speak, and particularly as you get older, your body clock can do that to you. They wake up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. There's nothing really to do. There's nobody to play with. The television's terrible. And there is a social expectation that you shouldn't be up doing stuff. But you've had 6 or 7 hours sleep. Mm. And particularly if you are not particularly physically active, all of those kind of things, you may not need as much sleep as you used to when you were younger. I mean, if you look at the declining sleep levels over the last 100 years. Everybody's been jumping up and down and saying, oh, it's a terrible thing. People are getting an hour and a half less sleep than they used to.
Mm.
There's certainly been some reduction in the amount of sleep that people are getting. But, you know, 100 years ago, 40% of the Australian workforce worked in rural agriculture. They were doing hard yakka and they were physically exhausted and their body needed more sleep in order to recover from the actual physical activity they undertook. Similarly today, young people, particularly men, can be a lot more physically active both through jobs and exercise and going to the gym and stuff. And so their body will sleep proportionally more. So changes that we're seeing in terms of the amount of sleep that people are getting, yes, some of it's to do with modern life and lights and screens and all of that, but in my view, a very significant proportion of the sleep we don't get anymore is because we're just not physically active. Mm. We have machines doing everything that we used to do by hand.
Right. So how do you think as a society, what do we need to be looking at to change that then?
And my grandmother would have told me this, that is, in many cases, our jobs and our lifestyles now, we suffer from massive physical inactivity.
Mm.
One of the first things that we will do with people is say, you need to be more physically active. Now, going to the gym, that can be a bit boring for most people. You have to be a certain kind of person to love running on the spot or pushing weights up and down. But, you know, get out and have a walk. Go and do stuff in the garden. You know, be physically active. And what we know is the more physically active you are, the more sleep juice, and that's not a very scientific term, but the more sleep juice you will generate, and therefore the better you will sleep. If it doesn't, and you are still experiencing the effects of not enough sleep, then that probably suggests that there's something more at work there. So often we'll do it by exclusion and say, come on, get a bit more physically active, get out there and do stuff. And particularly for people who have trouble staying asleep, that can be effective.
Mm.
Not so effective for people who have trouble falling asleep, because that's often related to anxiety, not necessarily in the medical psychiatric sense, but, you know, just worrying about the day.
Mm.
And what's interesting these days is people expect that they can just, like, turn off. They can watch Game of Thrones, do their email, and then be asleep in 5 minutes. And again, this expectation is it takes the body some time to get to sleep.
How long do you think that on average, I know it's very personalized, but how long do you think it is required for that wind down process?
Well, the more sleep juice you've got, the less time it takes.
Mm.
So particularly as people get a bit older or they have jobs that are physically inactive and mentally highly active, then the time taken to wind down can increase. And, you know, when you look at how busy people are these days and the amount of activity that's going on in their houses at night, they tend to forget that our bodies evolved to live on a savanna in Africa. And from sunset to sleep time, we'd sit around the campfire and tell stories to each other, rarely scaring each other as much as we like to think we were, but we weren't. And people typically would have 2, 3, 4 hours for their bodies to get ready to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
When we put people in the lab and make them physically inactive at that sleep onset period, we can see the really subtle changes of sleep, which is a shift in your body's thermoregulation and changes in hormone levels that typically take 1 to 2 hours of wind down before you will fall asleep.
And what do you have a good wind down strategy in place, or what can you recommend?
The Journal of International Statistics. Something quite boring and mundane. I was being a bit facetious about the journal, but, you know, don't watch super exciting television. Don't be, you know, busy doing all of the jobs that you have to do and expect to fall asleep in 2 minutes.
Mm.
We do a lot of work with people around rearranging their day so that they do the busy work and the cognitively demanding stuff earlier in the day, so they then have time to wind down. But particularly where people can be a bit anxious and they've got lots of stuff happening in their lives, it can be very useful to write lists down before you go to bed, so then you can go, I don't have to worry about forgetting that before the morning comes.
I'm a very good list maker. I'm totally on board with that one.
Yeah, and there are lots of simple things like that, which if you understand why you're having trouble sleeping, and lots of us live incredibly busy, complicated lives now.
So circling back to, we touched on it briefly before about mums, and you mentioned that this is a whole nother topic. Yep. You know, for the busy mind and the simulation and all the things that have to happen at nighttime that they just have to do, what do you recommend for them?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is you have to learn to plan better. And I know that's easily said, and you can say as a psychologist, you need to do lists and plan stuff so that when you do have downtime, you're not worrying about stuff you haven't done. But, you know, lots of people aren't that organised. Mm. It would be great if all the world were Virgos, although it probably wouldn't be if I think about it is important that people do that to the extent that they can. And again, it comes back to this thing. If it's causing a problem in your life and we suggest a treatment, and this is going to sound a bit cynical, but sometimes we offer very simple solutions to people and they can't do it. And we say, well, then how much of a problem is this? Mm-hmm. That is, if this is such a problem, you're not prepared to even make minor changes to your life, one might argue it's not necessarily a huge problem.
That's right.
And so sometimes we'll use that kind of somewhat confronting cognitive behavioral therapy stuff, which is to say you think it's a big problem, but it's not sufficiently problematic to cause you to change your behavior, which is somewhat paradoxical. So again, we'll have those kind of things. But one of the big issues for mothers is that their lives now are incredibly busy and what we would call brittle from a timing perspective. They've got so many things to do, kids to pick up, food, work, all of those kind of things. It's like a well-oiled machine. And if anything goes wrong and it falls over, there can be catastrophe. But the other thing is, even if it goes really well, lots of women who we see will say, I don't have a minute to myself from the moment I wake up till the moment I drop into bed exhausted. And then my husband's pestering me for sex anyway. So, one of the things that we found is a lot of people will wake up and then just use that time to reflect and think about all the things, not in a negative sense. There's just, that's the only time I have to think about stuff. And what's quite interesting is if you go back and look at the sociology of sleep over the last couple of hundred years in the West, then in the old days, they used to talk about the first and second sleep. Mm. And that there would be, because people would go to bed early because fuel was expensive and bed was a very cheap way to keep warm, people would typically go to bed not long after sunset, sleep for a couple of hours, wake up for a couple of hours, and then go back to sleep again. And that time between the first and second sleep, which looks to be quite a biological phenomenon, because if we put people into the lab and make them sleep for 13 or 14 hours a day to spend that time in bed, then their sleep goes into two bits and they have this waking period. I think for many women, that brief arousal during the night just is a time to actually have some personal space. And, you know, sometimes that's what you do. And sometimes I would say, well, maybe that personal space is more important than sleep for you at that point in time.
And again, this might sound, you know, some people might scoff at this, but I guess it comes back to what we were talking about before, where if it is so much of a problem, then make some changes.
Well, yes, and we'll often get to people to say, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, how much of a problem is it and what would you be prepared to do? So you may have seen an astounding statistic a couple of years ago where they talked to women and said, how many years of your life would you give up to have the perfect body? Mm. And I don't know if you've seen that research,
no.
But the result was astounding. Women would be prepared to trade between 5 and 10 years of their life for a perfect body, which is astounding if you think about it. But we'll often say to people something similar, which you will say, well, what would you give in exchange to be able to sleep better? And it's often when people are, when they really start to think about it, they go, actually, I have made choices and I'm not getting quite as much sleep as I probably would, but it is actually a choice I've made to not get sleep. That is, I've chosen other things to be more important. And then we'll say, do you really need to iron the underpants? Mm. Do you really? Or what could you let go that's not going to be the end of the world. And then we get start to get people to start to prioritise some things. But to, you've really got to get people to start to look at some fundamental values in their lives sometimes if they're not allocating enough time for sleep because of their busyness. And working mums are the biggest population for that, particularly in the COVID period, because they've had working from home, which has bled into all sorts of non-work time. Plus, they've often had homeschooling responsibilities in addition to their job.
So coming back to the better body weight topic, what are your thoughts? You know, this is such a big topic around sleep and weight loss. What can you tell us about the correlational connection here for those people that, you know, might be waking up early to exercise and maybe not having the full recovery time? What do you think the answer is there?
Yeah, look, it's a very controversial topic. The science at the moment is not definitive on this, but what we do know and is generally accepted is that if you short yourself on sleep, so let's say you need 7 to 7.5 hours sleep and you're only getting 6 to 6.5 hours sleep and you're an hour short, then there will be changes in your carbohydrate metabolism associated with that reduction in sleep. They're not huge changes, but what we'll find is that as people become sleep deprived, their body interprets that as a lack of energy and then shifts into, oh, I need more coffee and Mars bars. That is, I need more sugar and fat. And the body will go into food storage mode. So it will turn stuff into fat. So it makes it harder to lose weight, easier to put weight on. And your food preferencing also changes. And this is driven by a couple of hormones called leptin and ghrelin that are in your blood. And as one goes up and one goes down, they make you feel hungrier or more full. And when you're sleep deprived, it turns your body into a energy deficient state. That is, your body says, I'm tired, I must need energy, because if I'm not getting enough sleep, something stressful must be happening and I must be being chased by wild animals or something's going on. I'm having a war with my neighbouring tribe. So I need more energy in order to survive and because I'm going to be awake for longer. So the net effect of that is if you move into modern, you know, Western society is having people get a lot less sleep means that we would argue that as a result of that, people are eating more because of that energy metabolism change. They're exercising less, which would probably exacerbate the problem, and they have open access to highly nutrient-dense foods. So all of those work together to make it very easy to put on weight and very difficult to lose weight. The question is how much weight or how many calories equals how many hours of sleep? And the numbers on that turn out to be quite interesting. If you forego an hour or two sleep, it probably costs you 15 calories, which is not much.
No.
On the other hand, 15 calories a day for 20 years is a lot.
Mm.
That's 20 kilos.
Mm.
So while our energy metabolism is very finely tuned and it doesn't seem like it's a big cost, if it's happening every day for 20 years, it does. It's worth a kilo a year, basically. Mm. So what we're seeing in those situations, and you know, it leads to the interesting questions, how many extra hours of wakefulness can I get and how much exercise would I have to do? So if you think about it, you can probably burn off 15 or 20 calories in 15 or 20 minutes of vigorous exercise, you're still an hour and a bit up with extra weight. But it's what we sort of try and say to people is you need to think about it from a cost-benefit analysis. Sometimes you may choose to go without sleep. You know, a deadline happens to happen, you need an extra job, all of those kind of things.
Mm.
You've got to understand that there will be a consequence of that is that you put yourself at risk of putting on weight as a result of that sleep deprivation. But I will point out, it's very new and somewhat controversial research.
Yeah.
But I suspect when we look at the epidemiological data, people who have jobs that involve them sleeping less, by and large, are heavier.
Mm.
But, you know, the people who oppose that argument say, yeah, but shift workers who get less sleep and are heavier, they are also more likely to eat takeaway food because they can't access food at the same time as everybody else does, and it's actually a behavioural adaptation. It's not hormonal, blah, blah, blah. So it is controversial.
Mm-hmm. So on the other controversial topic, napping, what are your views on napping? I'm a big napper and I love it. I think that I get a lot out of it, but it is such a controversial topic.
I'm not sure why it's controversial. What do you think the controversy is?
There's so much research out there to say that you should not be napping, and that napping is bad, and that that people shouldn't consider napping because it has such an adverse effect on sleep.
Ah, okay. So, yeah, I mean, there are a couple of reasons you nap. The first reason that you nap is that you're tired. So if you are napping to make up for sleep loss previously, it's probably not so much of a problem. On the other hand, remember we talked a little bit earlier about disorders of excessive wakefulness? Some people do get bored and have a nana nap in the afternoon. And the thing to understand is that the human body is exquisitely tuned for sleep in the same way it is for calories. That is, most people will maintain the same proportion of the day in sleep remarkably consistently. If you live a lifestyle where you do that all at night and you do have a nap during the day, then you will reduce the amount of sleep that you need the following night. So, and you'll see that, just stay up later. Mm. That can't be a hard problem. But if you have a nap and then try to sleep the next night and get the same amount of sleep, it's not going to happen.
Mm.
You're going to struggle to get to sleep, or you're going to wake up earlier, or usually you struggle to get to sleep. And there's a couple of reasons for that. First is your body only needs so much sleep, or gets used to so much sleep. And it's okay to mix that around. And there are cultures in the world, for example, what we would call siesta cultures, where people get exactly the same amount of sleep as they do in other countries. They just get it in two bits a day instead of one bit a day.
Mm.
And the point being is, if you're going to nap, stay up later and short yourself on sleep if you've had an extra nap. And if you're having a catch-up nap, you're probably okay.
Great.
Now, where it gets more complicated is, while napping is good and all sleep aids in recovery and makes you healthy, wealthy, and wise, one of the problems with napping is, depending on how long you nap for, influences how you feel when you wake up and how long it takes your brain to get going again.
Mm.
So if you've had a decent nap, and typically one that's kind of 45 minutes or longer, then your body gets into deep sleep. And then, of course, it takes a while to wake up as a result of it. And that feeling of feeling like crap when you wake up is worse, particularly if you have a nap in the middle of the night, if you're a shift worker, because then your body really wants to be asleep. If you're going to nap, all napping is good and all napping will benefit you. But what you've got to understand is that under certain circumstances, it can take 30 minutes to wake up as a result of a nap. So in the worst situations, most people will be back to their peak alertness within 30 minutes of waking up from a nap. But if we measure people immediately after a nap, some people say, oh, I felt like crap when I first woke up. And that's true. But just if that is the case, just wake 30 minutes. And we know that when we do it in the lab, we always wait 30 minutes after sleep period to get people to assess their alertness because of the time we know it takes to get going again. So napping is great. And in companies or organizations where people are allowed to nap because of the nature of their work, that's fine, but don't jump in an ambulance and drive at 100 km 2 minutes after waking up from a 45 minute nap. That's not going to end well.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. I am going to continue my napping. I'd love to know before we finish up, is there any other research that you're looking at the moment that's new and exciting that that you can share with us?
Most of our work in the last couple of years has been looking at how shift workers manage night shift in particular. And what we've been looking at, and this flows on from the napping that you've talked about, is that we're looking at who are the most successful people at working shift work that involves working nights. And one of the things that we've identified is that there is what's called a split sleep strategy. That is, where people are going on to night shift traditionally what people would do is get up because they'd slept the night before, and because they didn't have to go to work, they'd sleep in till 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. Then they'd get up, and then the logic would be, oh, I'm going on night shift. I've got all this stuff to get done. I'm not going to be able to do it during the day. So they work flat out, go to work that night, and by the time they finish their first night shift, they're at the low point in the body clock and they've been up for 24 hours or so. And then they are really fatigued. That combination of being at the low point in your body clock and having been awake for a really long time is what we call the deadly double. And we know from accident statistics and all of that kind of stuff, that's the time that people are really at risk, particularly if they're driving. Mm. What we identified was that there's a couple of people who we started to talk to who had a slightly different strategy. And what they do is they go, oh, I'm going on to night shift. So I'll stay up late the night before, so I'm a bit short of sleep. Mm-hmm. Make sure they get up at the normal time. And then they'll have a little nap in the afternoon before they go to work. So depending on whether on a 12-hour shift or an 8-hour shift, they'll typically have a nap in the early afternoon or the late afternoon and then get up and go to work. The benefit for those people is that, particularly if they have a nap for an hour or two, they haven't been awake for anywhere near as long by the time they get to the early hours of the morning. And as a result, if they're undertaking activities that put them at risk of fatigue-related errors, they can be a lot safer. So that split sleep strategy seems to be one that's very effective for people. And we're starting to see that that could be recommended, particularly as people work longer and longer sequences of night shifts in many occupations. So that's where we're kind of having fun at the moment.
Great.
In terms of learning from people who have worked out how to do it based on experience and then trying to understand why it is that that works from a physiological and biological perspective.
Well, that, I mean, it seems to make sense in theory, so it'll be interesting to see where that ends up.
Yeah, never let the facts get in the way of a good story, but yes, it's a plausible hypothesis and we're testing it to see how much better it works. But the initial results suggest that it might be quite a good strategy.
And I know another area that you're looking at is around the ancient dream temples, which is a topic that I would love to talk to get you back on and do a segment on that. Maybe you can give us a little teaser.
Oh, well, it's quite interesting. If you go back and look into history of medicine, the first hospitals were actually quite simple because we didn't have a lot of medicine and we didn't have much equipment and technology. But the first hospitals turned out to be temples where you would go to be cured by the gods. And what would happen is you would troop along to the hospital or the temple, and then you would sleep, and you would sleep at the foot of one of the gods that you worshipped at the time. And some gods were thought to be better at this because they were gods of healing and medicine and those kind of things. And you would sleep at your feet, and then you would have a visit from the god in your sleep who would either tell you what was wrong with you and what you needed to do to cure it. And that worked very well for about 1,000 years. And after about 1,000 years, the priests of the temple decided that it would be much better if they interpreted your dream for you and told you what was wrong with you and what the treatment would be and charged you money for it. So the notion of fee-for-service medicine has its origins in the dream temples of ancient Greece and Egypt, because it turned out that the priests were much better, in their opinion, at interpreting the meaning of the dreams. And so we saw dreams being self-interpreted, where a god appeared to me and told me this was what I'd done wrong or this was the problem and here's what I needed to do to fix it, to ones where the content became symbolic and required somebody to interpret it. And that's what became our modern psychoanalysis.
Right.
Those are professional to interpret your dreams, to work out what's wrong with you and what you need to do to fix yourselves.
Fascinating. I love the fact that there's so much history behind and that there are some answers and some substance around, you know, where we are today and looking back to see how we can, you know, I guess lean into all of that to shape where we need to move forward.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, what's the old expression? Everything old is new again.
Absolutely.
We're starting to see a whole new movement around people using their dreams as part of the well-being process. And I don't mean that in the new agey kind of way, but just in the sense is that dreaming is a universal human and mammalian phenomena. It's obviously there for a reason and obviously has some meaning. And in the last few years, we have seen a big shift away from the Freudian psychoanalytic view to the what I'd call the filter of the swimming pool back flushing itself model. Mm-hmm. Now that's kind of reached its peak and we're starting to move back to say, what is it that the dream means and what value could it add to understanding our place in the world and our well-being?
Mm, great. Well, let's dive into that one in a couple of weeks if you're available.
I'd love to now that we know how to work Zoom.
Thank you for listening to The Goodnight Show. If you're keen to learn more about our guests or any of the topics we've spoken about today, hop on over to the Goodnight Co. closed Facebook community group or check us out at thegoodnightco.com.au. And if you're enjoying the show, please subscribe to us on your favourite podcast provider by searching The Goodnight Show. And if you love what you're hearing, don't forget to leave us a glowing review. Thanks, everyone.